Mr. Erica, reel 8.
It gave us something to do with sweeping up this snow, and I suppose it helped, really. A little bit less boredom, although we moaned about it at the time. You got the fear of the unknown and the hope and the anticipations and emotions to which all men are prey, and it had all brought about a comradeship, which is a very special kind, really. Even now, what, 37, 38 years later, it brings a lump to our throats whenever we meet. I suppose it's a bond which time can never erode, and really we wouldn't want it to. The sick and wounded, they'd been released, I suppose it was about the spring of 53, and we thought then that, you know, the end is in sight. We didn't think, I didn't think too much about it, really. If they were sick or wounded, I mean, probably they were legless or armless or something like that. They were going home, and I guess we would one day. It was about 3 months later we were told that we were going to be sold something special that would make us very happy. Well, we guessed what it was, and the usual wait on the square for the company commander to come, and he speaks to us in Chinese, and then our friend, the Screaming Skull, translated it all. You will be going home to your families and loved ones. The usual lecture, no one batted an eyelid. We just turned back to our rooms to discuss the event. I suppose it was the stiff British upper lip at its best. And it goes without saying that the Americans, they went wild. They were shouting and screaming and cheering. We couldn't see them, but we could hear them. We, you know, one knew where they were, obviously, in the camp. And they just go bananas. I don't know. Why so excitable? I say, after that first 51, that first 12 months, we realised perhaps then that we would get out, that it wasn't a bottomless pit, even if it did take the 10, 20 or 30 years. Things were so much better. One was bored. That was the biggest problem.
Did the Chinese ever comment to you on the difference between British and American POWs?
No, not that I can recall. No. They may have done. We may have told them. But not that one recalls. But I suppose, again, it was those written tests that we did early in after the lectures that sort of now came out to decide who went first, because they'd split the British into two lots. I was on the second lot, and half of them went off, and that sort of brought a lump to one's throat. And next morning, anyway, Albert Spur and I, we detailed to go and tidy up a Chinese library. Those the books are going back to China or something, in another part of the camp. Anyway, off we go, and we're tidying up, and I spot this book there, United Nations POWs in Korea. And, of course, we knew that we'd only got 2 or 3 days left there, you see. And I thought, blow that for a lark, I'm not leaving that here. So I took it, shoved it in my shirt. And there was a Chinese girl there, soldier, and she was sort of watching us and doing a bit, I suppose, tidying up as well. Anyway, we finished and we went outside, and then another Chinese came along, a bloke, and she said something to him. And then he turned to us and said, "Can I have the book one of you took, please?" And I thought, blimey, O'Reilly, I've had it. You know, so near and yet so far. So I took this book out and gave it back to them. And that was it. Nothing happened. We went back to the rooms, and I thought, well, you know, they're bound to send for me. But they didn't. And the next morning, they came round and gave us each one of these books, United Nations POWs in Korea. So that was 3 times, basically, with the swimming and the guy with the rock and the Luger, that one could have been hauled up and perhaps put in the hole and sort of punished, self-criticism, and got away with it each time. Never understand why or how one did it. It was incredible. However, I guess it was about the 6th of August, 1953, at about 8:30, we crossed the river by barge, and then they put us in trucks to the railhead. But as we went onto these trucks, and it was a terrible journey along this mountain road, and literally a cliff straight up one side, and the other side a sheer drop. I can't remember whether the river was down there or whether it was a valley or a bit of both. But this blessed guy driving the truck, he was going bananas. And we were saying to each other, you know, all this way, and he's going to have us over the side in a minute. 2.5 years, and we're killed on the way out. But we managed, and we got into these box cars at the railhead. I don't know where it was, I'm sure. And I think that probably took the best part of a day to get there. We stopped about halfway at a sort of a transit camp. There was plenty of food there, and smiles from all the guards, you know, they couldn't have been nicer. And loads of prisoners. We had to go to what they called Freedom Village. Politics to the end, of course, with the Chinese. And I can't remember a lot about it, but I can remember that everything was very new. And we spent a couple of days there, and we slept on three-tier bunks, and they were rather close together, sort of thing. Not really enough room, but I suppose they just had to get them in. And then 9th of August, 1953, the great day had arrived. And after an early breakfast, it's 7 o'clock that was, and one always had an early breakfast in the army if one was being moved from one sort of unit to another or going out on courses or anything like that. When you were travelling, you always had an early breakfast, and this is something that stuck in my mind. We had an early breakfast. And we got onto the truck at about 8 o'clock, for our journey to Panmunjom, and off we go. It took about an hour, but along the road we passed all countless items of American equipment, and we could only say, and it proved factual afterwards, I suppose, that it was from the released Chinese and the North Koreans. They'd thrown it off once they'd got on their side, presumably to show their disgust in the capitalist system. But there was it was all over the side of the road, all the way along. And when we got off the truck, they, you know, welcomed us home, the big brass and that sort of thing. And the first job was to be deloused, and we had to put our arms out, and there was an American on either side with a DDT squirter up each sleeve he was, and down the front of our trousers. But we all said, if only they knew. They haven't got a clue. I can't remember whether in interrogation office came next or the shower and a change into the jungle greens, but we stayed there one night, and of course several of them got drunk, and then Royal Australian Air Force, it was, flew us to Osaka in Japan, and that's where we were met by Peggy Morden. She was from the WVS, and she came back with us on the boat to UK, and we landed at Osaka and then travelled by boat up the Inland Sea to Kure and reinforcement base depot there. And the boys who'd been released earlier were all waiting for us, and we were shown the barracks where we were, and it was all very lush. All the kit was laid out, everything. Your 8th Hussars cap badge and your collar dogs, numerals, medal ribbons, which we didn't see before, you see. I mean, lots of the others had got theirs, obviously, through being in the Second World War, but us younger ones, we hadn't got medals, so it was all very, very special. I can remember thinking, here we are, a veteran at 22. We had documentation and medicals, and then were free to visit the Hero and Curie flesh spots and souvenirs. There were lots of them about. If you bought a metal suitcase and you saw, well, I don't know, I suppose probably, I don't know how many chaps there were on that boat, but there were, one would say perhaps hundreds, but there were dozens of them, I would think, without any argument. Of these metal suitcases, if you bought one from the Japanese guy, you would put your name on there free, and you saw all these squatted these metal suitcases, various sizes, sort of thing. Then, I suppose we were there for about 5 days or something like that. We'd got the VIP treatment, and bar for a little bit of documentation in the morning, the rest of our time was our own. We'd go down to Curie and have a scout round and all the rest of it. Several of the chaps were flown back for compassionate reasons, but I think personally the sea trip, it helped us just a little bit to normal life again. I don't know. There were there was a lot of talk, obviously, now that we'd got released, that Andy Condren wasn't with us. Why or who or whatever reasons were his, but rightly or wrongly, he decided to stay behind and go to China. We all had the choice before we left, and those of us who knew Andy in Camp 5 and had, and yes, we still have, the very highest regard for him. And I'm quite sure he did more for the British POWs than the next 20 of us put together. And he was often with the Chinese when the rest of us were going about our daily skylarking, and he did his share of the dirty jobs. He told me once that he was beaten up on interrogation, so he had no real reason perhaps to go and think that he might get beaten up again or whatever. I don't know whether they told him he would be treated extra special. I met some ex-Marines in the Tower of London, and you could see they were Korean chaps because they'd got the medal ribbons up. And I said to them, "Oh, you were with 41 Commando?" They said, "Yes." I said, "Oh, you know Dickie Richards and Andy Condren? Don't talk to me about Condren," they said. I said, "Why not? He's a bloomin' traitor." They said, I said, "Why?" I said, "Were you in the prisoner of war camp?" "Oh, no," they said. I said, "Well, you don't know what you're talking about then." And they didn't.
But they said it's just easy. On the grounds that he'd decided
that
to
he'd
stay.
That he'd decided to stay, yes. I mean, it's easy for those who don't know to judge, but again, who was it who said, "Let he who is free from sin cast the first stone"? One can perhaps say no more. And he's come home since, and we're all pleased to see him. I suppose, without any doubt, career is indelibly printed on one's mind, and not a day or a week goes by without remembering some aspect of it. You remember those who died in Happy Valley? Captain Ashley Cooper and, Mr. Alexander, even a name who was synonymous with the Irish regiments within the British Army. And one feels surely if he'd lived, he would have gone to the very pinnacle of his career. And Ted Collins was called from reserve, and all the other boys. It's, you know, one remembers those who died in the camp. Well, you couldn't do anything for them. Just a memory. Just a memory, that's all, really. It's just remember absent friends. I think, possibly to finish, there was a poem somebody wrote after Kipling's If. Again, the notebooks came into this, and a lot of them would write down various poems, but this one was adapted from If. And as far as I can remember it, I don't know who the chap was who wrote it, or rewrote it, if you like, but it goes something like, "If you can fight under the banner of white and the blue, if you can live in little mud huts slung up off the ground, if you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to move those weary legs forward on the long march north, if you can eat your millet, barley, pork and beans, not forget roast beef and apple pie, if you can bury your mates and serve your time long after they are gone, if you can hold on when dysentery strikes again, again and again, and there is nothing left except the will that says hold on, if you can listen to all the lies about the blood of the Korean people on your hands and still not deal in lies, if you can take your dreams to loved ones across the sea when all you can hear is the ranting of the screaming skull, if you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distant run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a British soldier, my son."
So that was the Camp 5.
That was the Camp 5 version of Kipling's If. I know it was British, but I mean, I don't know who he was.